It's Thursday, January 27, 2011. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The big news in foreign affairs comes from Egypt this morning, where for the last 72 hours or so, massive demonstrations, including thousands of persons, have filled the streets of Cairo and other major Egyptian cities. The protest is against the three-decades-long rule of Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. You'll remember that Mubarak took office almost immediately after the assassination of previous Egyptian President Anwar Sadat. Sadat, who along with Israeli Premier Menachem Begin won the Nobel Peace Prize for their efforts to achieve a stable Middle East and to achieve a state of peace between Egypt and Israel, had been assassinated by members of the Muslim Brotherhood, an extremist group that was, in many ways, a forecast of things to come in terms of Islamic extremism. Now, 3 decades later, Mubarak is still in power, and those who are observers of his regime, a very dictatorial, totalitarian regime by the standards of a modern Western democracy, have noticed he appears to be moving even members of his own family into an implied line of succession. Those who filled the streets of Cairo and other cities, and remember by the tens of thousands, were protesting the Mubarak regime. This is something new. Egypt, along with Tunisia and others of the Muslim nations in North Africa, have been considered oases of stability in an otherwise rather unstable region. But that stability appears to be giving way to a new instability, as a revolutionary fervor has, of course, toppled a regime in Tunisia, and now genuinely seems to threaten the three-decade rule of Hosni Mubarak. Now, there's something else that's interesting going on here. The Egyptian regime immediately claimed that this particular protest and the presence of all of these men and women in the streets, young in particular, was due to the organizational impetus of the Muslim Brotherhood. In other words, they blamed a Muslim extremist organization that is and has been well known to be an enemy of the regime. But what makes it really interesting is the fact that it appears on the ground that there is no way the Muslim Brotherhood could have instigated a protest of this magnitude. Furthermore, and this is even of greater interest, it appears that those who are on the streets of Cairo and other major Egyptian cities do not have a major ideological bent. That means they do not appear to be acting as Muslim extremists. They do not appear to have any particular ideological invective to throw against this regime or any ideological plan to establish some new form of government. What they want is freedom. What they want is the end to a dictatorial regime. What they want is the end to this political dynasty. That's the kind of revolution that in the span of recent world history is far more likely to be successful. We'll see in this case. In any event, this is not good news for the United States, which is counted on Egypt as a stable negotiating partner in the Middle East. If Egypt itself becomes unstable over a period of time, this certainly creates big new challenges for American foreign policy. But it's not just that. Egypt, even after all these years, has been able to maintain normalized relations with Israel. It is the only Arab state to do so. That means if there is a toppling of the regime in Egypt, it could lead to real problems not only for the United States, but for Israel, and by extension in terms of the issue of stability, to the rest of the Arab world as well. This is another sign that world politics often comes up when the unexpected occurs. We come to understand that the shape of the world as we know it now has been established not by some grand foreign policy scheme or plan, as was attempted in the Age of Empire, but more often as nations and the peoples within those nations seek their own process of self-determination. It's going to be fascinating to watch what goes on in Egypt. If Tunisia is any example, it will not take long to find out just where this particular unrest is headed. The other big foreign policy story to watch centers in Davos, Switzerland, that small alpine village which is host to the World Economic Forum. What we see going on there over the next several days is a gathering of the world's business and economic elite, the corporate czars of commerce, regardless of their nationality and citizenship. For the last several years or so, observers have identified the type who appear at this meeting as Davos Man, the new intelligentsia, the new international elite, and they wield an extraordinary power. What makes them different from previous elites? Well, largely the fact that they appear to have more commitment to their own economic interests than to their national interests, international in scope rather than national in allegiance. We'll be talking more of that in coming days. In the meantime, watch the gathering in Davos and understand that what's going on there can affect everything from the color of paint that is sold in your local store to the value of the currency in your bank account. The New York Times featured a very interesting front page story in recent days that is something of the sign of the times. Laura Holson reports that several funeral homes are now allowing mourners to gather on the web for funerals and memorial services. This is something that was probably inevitable. After all, in the digital age, the collapse of space means that meetings can now take place with individuals seated in their own homes or offices, with the meeting gathering by digital space those who may be separated in physical space by thousands of miles. As this particular story indicates, and Ms. Holson reports, funerals and memorial services in years past have been major opportunities, if not obligations, for travel and gathering. But, as she writes, several software companies have created easy-to-use programs to help funeral homes cater to bereaved families. Funeral One, a one-stop shop for online memorials that is based in St. Clair, Michigan, has seen the number of funeral homes offering webcasts increase to 1,053 in 2010 from just 126 in 2008. The company also sells digital tribute DVDs. End quote. Once again, this is probably inevitable. The rise of a technology like this allows for a webcast of a funeral, which in the first place makes it possible for persons who would have been prevented from attending the actual service to participate. It also allows the memorial to be perpetuated as, after all, just like the everlasting presence of YouTube allows videos to go on again and again and again, a memorial service can be shared and the loved ones can actually repeat it again in terms of the webcast. But there's something more going on here and we all know it. When it becomes possible not to go to the effort to attend in terms of a personal attendance at a funeral or memorial service, it isn't long until those bonds that bind us together are weakened even as they are strengthened. That's the double-edged sword of the technological revolution. And this particular front page story in the New York Times is not just one that pulls at the heartstrings, as of course there is a great deal of emotion invested in a funeral. It's also one that points that, well, if you thought about it, there's a big commercial angle to this as well. There is big business to be made. Even in a time of recession or even economic depression, people continue to die, and funeral homes and the entire industry surrounding death and funerals and memorial services continues. The webcast is just another opportunity. Christians do have a deep investment in terms of bereavement. As we are reminded in the New Testament, we do not grieve as others grieve, as those who have no hope, but there is real grief. A memorial service, and more particularly a funeral, which is the Christian tradition with the body present, this has been a very important part of the Christian process of grieving. Being present in the room, well, yes, there is a premium put upon that, even as the Christian religion is a congregational shape. But at the same time, there is something to be gained, just as with other social media, by allowing persons very distant to be able to participate in this way. Persons who could not, for reasons of health or transportation, be present. Just for an example, soldiers who are serving in Afghanistan and Iraq can attend certain funerals by means of this technology. That's a good thing. As with so many of these technologies, they give even as they take away. The rise of competing cable news networks has been one of the major shaping forces in terms of the contemporary media. Whereas, just a couple of decades ago, the news was limited on television to the three broadcast networks, NBC, CBS, and ABC, with ABC actually being a latecomer to that triumvirate, now there is a cable news constellation that includes new initials and names such as Fox News and, of course, the venerable CNN, and MSNBC. Well, there are big changes at MSNBC. In particular, last Friday was the very last appearance of Keith Olbermann, one of the most incendiary of the left-leaning columnists and hosts at MSNBC. Now, there are several interesting facets of this. The most interesting is not what we know, but what we don't know. Olbermann and MSNBC signed an agreement that they will not discuss his departure from the network, its reasons, or its meaning. There is no doubt that, as several media reports have indicated, there was no shortage of bad blood between the NBC executives and Mr. Olbermann. But he did draw an audience, and in cable news, that's the big secret. If you draw an audience, you generally keep your job. I'll tell you the truth, I have often watched MSNBC in terms of national news coverage because I already know pretty much what the conservative networks are going to say. I want to hear what is going to come from the liberal side. I did find it very difficult to watch Mr. Olbermann. There was a meanness in terms of his delivery that indicated that there was far more to this than an ideological investment. Well, what we're now getting in terms of the backstory from MSNBC is that his relations with the executives there were pretty much marked by the same kind of concern. In all likelihood, MSNBC will fill that slot with someone equally liberal and perhaps even equally incendiary. But as with politicians and preachers and all others, it comes down to a personality. And the personality of Keith Olbermann was one that did draw a crowd, but also drew a great deal of uncomfortableness, not only among his viewers, but among the executives that own and run the network. MSNBC is now under new corporate control and corporate leadership. We'll be watching what happens in MSNBC. It adopted the motto, you'll remember, in recent months of lean forward, indicating that it was going to embrace and publicly own its left-leaning tendencies, to be opposite Fox News with a more conservative slant. There's a real leveling out process going on in terms of the cable news media right now. There may be one less familiar face, but there is still the familiar trio of the networks, with CNN rather solidly in the middle. Fox News is drawing by far the largest audience, and that's what's driving many of the folks at the other networks absolutely nuts. But regardless of which cable news network you watch, if any, what we need to keep in mind, of course, is that there is no way through any of those networks that the most substantial news stories can be both presented and documented and analyzed. That's why none of these cable news networks will replace the substantial editorial weight of print media. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. For more information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.